Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife. This is Kevin, and I'm here with Jason, and we have some exciting news to let you know about.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. So we are now pleased to offer bundle and institutional sales for our Behind the Knife premium products. The bundle includes our general surgery oral board audio review, our trauma surgery video atlas, and our oral board audio reviews for vascular, colorectal, surgical oncology, and cardiothoracic surgery. We offer institutional discounts to our bundle and individual premium products.
Yeah, so all of this is available via our new website and app, where you can take notes, pin chapters, and download chapters for offline viewing, both on the website and the app. So please email hello@behindtheknife.org and check out the show notes to learn more.
And remember, this isn't only for board review. You can use our content to prepare throughout the year and provide didactic learning across all levels for all residents.
So level up the education at your institution and let your program directors know that Behind the Knife can be bought in institutional packages and in bundle pricing. All right, let's get back to the episode.
Hello, and welcome to Behind the Knife. Thank you for joining us for an episode of our new global surgery series, where we discuss the past, present, and future of global surgery, as well as numerous foundational topics within this exciting and important field. Today, we wanted to take a special focus on how health infrastructure interacts with global surgery initiatives and what global surgery is in and of itself. With our experienced and influential guests, we hope we can learn more about how global surgery exemplifies the impact of health infrastructure and some of the keys to systems-level change to improve access to surgical care in resource-limited settings. I'm John Williams. I'm one of the Behind the Knife Fellows. With me today, we have Dr. Sudha Jayaraman and Dr. Justina Shea Olajide. Dr. Jayaraman is a trauma surgeon and acute care surgeon at the University of Utah and the director of the Center for Global Surgery there. After attending UC Davis for medical school, Dr. Jayaraman completed general surgery residency at UCSF, during which time she also obtained a master's in public health in developing countries from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. During this time, her efforts were dedicated to researching and implementing trauma systems development in Uganda. After residency training, she then completed a trauma and critical care fellowship at Brigham and Women's, during which she received a Harvard Medical School Health Disparities Fellowship to continue her trauma systems work in Rwanda. Her ongoing work investigating injury burden and trauma systems in low and middle income countries has been well funded by the NIH, Department of Defense, and others, and published in numerous forums, as she is a well-renowned expert in the field. Dr. Shea Olajide is a pediatric surgeon at the Lagos University Teaching Hospital in Lagos, Nigeria. She completed her medical school training at the Ahmadu Bello University in Zaria, Nigeria, and subsequently her general surgical and pediatric surgical training at the Lagos University Teaching Hospital, earning the fellowship of West African College of Surgeons in Pediatric Surgery and the Alinta Wako Prize for the best graduating pediatric surgical trainee. Dr. Shea Olajide's vision is to provide equal, equitable pediatric surgical care in resource-limited settings and has been highly influential for developing initiatives such as the National Surgical Obstetric Anesthesia and Nursing Plan for Nigeria. Additionally, she is a member of the Global Initiative for Children's Surgery and has well published her original research on topics regarding access to pediatric surgical care in low and middle income countries. Thank you both again for joining us. We're really excited to have you on the show. So I guess to start, you know, both of you have dedicated so much time and effort to global surgery initiatives, but I'm sure that there's probably been a lot of steps on the journey to get to where you are today. So could you both maybe start by telling us just a little bit about your story and your experiences that brought you to prominent work in global surgery as you do today?
Sure. Tian, you want to go first? You want to go first?
You can go first. I'll go up to you.
All right. Great. Yeah. Thanks, John. It's great to be here and great to be part of this podcast. So when I went to medical school, I really didn't have any kind of experience in terms of what kind of career path I wanted to have. There were very few medical people in my family at all. So when I got into that path, I had been previously very interested in a much broader area that had to do with epidemiology and environmental studies and health, which is what I had majored in. as a college student, but I really couldn't figure out how to tie that into what I was interested in medicine until I was inspired by a trauma surgeon whose work I just started to hear about in the early days, which is Dr. Charlie Mott from the University of Washington, Seattle. He's a trauma surgeon. He became one of the first leaders at the WHO for essential surgical care. And he was looking at how do you improve systems to deliver trauma care in other countries. And I, as an immigrant to the United States, I kind of always had that sense of there are two different worlds that I live in and two different worlds that I have to think about. And that was one of the first times I had imagined connecting what was going to be an interest in surgery with an interest in something broader, which is how does surgical care affect people around the world and what kind of big picture systems need to exist to provide health at a larger scale. I'll turn it over to Tina now.
Thanks, Peter. And thanks, John, for having me here. I guess for me, my story comes from my experiences. You know, I've always had concerns about the large population in my country, Nigeria, that didn't have access to, you know, the much needed surgical care that they should have. And I remember as a medical student in my institution, we offered basic and advanced surgical care to people. And as the cost of care kept rising, and it's been rising until today, the patient population kept dwindling because of out-of-pocket payments. And then you ask yourself, what's happening to these patients? The incidence of disease are not getting any, and are reducing, or fewer patients are coming to access the care because of increased cost. And fast forward to my residence training days, you know, would have the M&M meetings, and you'd have, you know, a number of patients with poor outcomes. And most of the reasons why they had poor outcomes were actually things that could be tackled preventable. Most of them would come late, you know, advanced disease, peritonitis, coming after a week. And ultimately, that patient gets, you know, you lose the patient. And then, of course, it's not the surgeon's fault. You know, I think there were systemic issues as well. And so you begin to ask, how can we help to improve this or change the narrative? Because something can be done to actually change this, right? It wasn't until after I completed my residency training that I had the opportunity of meeting mentors, very influential mentors, that have given me opportunities to work within the global surgery space. And really, my story has been that of, like, you know, going on the backs of these people and getting involved in little initiatives and eventually getting involved in things that could actually make an impact to make a difference. So that's why I'm here.
I think that's great. And I think it's definitely probably one of the central ideas, which is, you know, surgical care doesn't start and stop in the hospital or the operating room. And yeah, I think that's definitely probably an important consideration, depending on the setting that you're in, is to think about what's around you as well as just your task as a surgeon. Is well beyond just doing the operations themselves. So I guess, you know, the next thing that is probably worth talking about is just talk about what global surgery is, you know, kind of like trying to create that definition, because I think myself included, there's lots of folks out there that are early on in their surgical careers, and the concept of broadening impact for better is something that sounds really worthwhile, but I think it's intimidating at the same time just because there's so much out there.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think to think about what global surgery is, we have to think about a little bit of what the history of surgeons engaging in partnerships is all about. You know, surgeons, doctors, nurses, you know, we're all in it because we want to make the world a better place, right? That's the whole motivation. And, you know, historically, there were a lot of people who were traveling from one country to the other to think about providing services, to think about setting up medical schools or hospitals or a variety of different things, just as they would do in their own home countries. And this humanitarian focus led to all those NGOs and has been a great inspiration. And that transitioned in some ways to this discussion of international health being something that people in rich countries do in poor countries, which left a lot of unsettled kind of impression. And this is historically. And then that kind of led to this terminology change to say global health. We're all part of one globe. So how can we all be accountable for what's happening in our communities? And how can we help each other in each other's communities? And that broadening of view from us versus them, or having to go somewhere to deliver care, is what it's all about to think about global surgery. It's how do we think about surgical care around the globe, whether it's in a resource limited setting in the United States, talking about inner city Detroit or rural Utah on the Indian Health Service Native American reservations, or anywhere else in the world. What are the things that we need to think about to deliver surgical care in those spaces? Now, it's a pretty broad definition, and not everybody necessarily agrees with that, because actually there isn't a written down definition that everybody agrees on for what global surgery is. But the thought is, how do we think about it not as having to go somewhere, one place to the other? Because if you say it's all about going somewhere, then, well, is there only expertise in certain countries? Could there never be expertise in another country if you're talking about going from the US to India or Botswana? Will there never be a global surgeon in Botswana or India who will have that expertise? And the answer can't be, yes, that's appropriate, right? I mean, we can all recognize that. There's expertise everywhere in different systems. Just like I couldn't work in a different hospital in Montana without having some understanding of what that context is. So that's really the direction that this field that's formalizing is going to. And it's thinking about geography agnostic, globally accountable surgical systems. Justina, you might have a different version of it. What do you
think? So, I mean, I think she's put it very well and succinctly, very succinctly put that, yeah, even though global surgery is all about increasing access to safe, quality, affordable surgical care, the understanding has been deepened beyond thought of, oh, it's someone moving from a high-income country to a low-income country to deliver some form of surgical care to people who don't have access to it, because that also speaks back to the, in a sense, words people don't really like to talk about, neocolonialistic origins of global health, right? You know, where it's like, oh, we're going to help and we're going to save them, right? But the attention has shifted towards, look, empowering even the locals so they can provide locally contextualized care to their own people. And then having people also do carry out locally contextualized interventions to strengthen their own surgical systems where they are. And like you rightly said, the needy areas, the low-resource areas are not just in LMICs. You know, there are the indigenous populations in HICs who also need those. So you don't need to travel to somewhere else to participate in global surgery. Even within your region, your continent, you can look around and see places where the need is and attend to those needs where you are. And then if there are gaps available in other areas, then you can collaborate in a bilateral fashion, you know, where everyone, we're helping ourselves in a bilateral fashion, right, to strengthen these surgical systems across board. And if anything, COVID has made us realize that the world is really just one place. It's one globe. Everything is so interconnected, right? And as long as there are deficits in one region of the world, it's going to affect the other part of the world, whether we like it or not. I think a few misconceptions, another misconception that exists is that global surgery is an elitist field. And that happens more to the LMIC folks. Oh, it's elitist for a specific group of people. No, everyone can participate and contribute in some way in global surgery, from a medical student to a resident doctor to a specialist surgeon, and even to paramedical people that are not cost anesthetists, lab technicians. Everyone has a role to play in strengthening the surgical system, and everyone can get involved in global surgery.
No, I think that's super inspiring. And I think like what I'm hearing a lot is that the needs of one community or one population are unique almost. Like, you know, not everyone's needs are the same, whether it's a country, whether it's a community, whether it's a town or a city. And so it sounds to me that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the key facets to a successful global surgery effort in providing better access to surgical care is identifying and understanding what that population needs. I certainly could imagine that the population of Ann Arbor, Michigan needs a lot of different things compared to the population in Lagos, Nigeria, or something like that. What are some things that, you know, I think surgical care has some uniqueness to it. What are some things that you think that surgical care resembles other global health initiatives? And then what are some things that you think might differ a little bit? So obviously, you know, I think providing surgical care requires so many stakeholders and resources. And how do those similarities and differences kind of intertwine?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you think about surgical systems, because that's what we're talking about, is strengthening surgical systems around the globe. One thing that I've been involved in is to say, well, one, what does that actually mean? And is there a way we can all learn that or teach that? And what are the core fundamentals of what we're talking about? And so we actually developed a set of competencies for what academic global surgery is all about, which covers like health economics as it applies to surgical systems. Well, that's going to be very different if you think about what the healthcare system is in Thailand versus in Rwanda. And so understanding that perspective before you can think about how would you intervene in that surgical system is really important. So that's one example. And so we kind of actually systematically went through a global collaboration of investigators and colleagues to come up with what are these fundamentals that we would want to teach a global surgery fellow or student interested in global surgery or a clinician, like a surgeon or anesthesiologist interested in that. So, and that then trickles to what are the systems aspects that we need to think about. From an academic standpoint, you know, we're trying to formalize this into a field, just like transplant surgery is a field. It's like global health is a field. And to say, well, that includes these different understandings of health systems as they apply to surgical care, surgical epidemiology that can be different from country to country or region to region, and a variety of different topics along those lines. So understanding the education, understanding the research needs, understanding the innovation needs are all different aspects of surgical systems strengthening efforts. Justina, over to you. What do you think?
Yeah, I think those are very good points you've already said. Just to add a little bit to what you said, I think one key thing that has been very different about global surgery, you know, when compared to other global health initiatives, the fact that, so let me just say what is similar first is that global health, global surgery, they try to improve access for population in need. So global health is about improving access to medicines, to reproductive health, to mental health. That's global health. Global surgery focuses on improving access to quality surgical care, right? But then when you talk about the differences, you know, I mean, some of the things that really bother us is the fact that unlike other initiatives, right, where they're able to quickly garner funding support, you know, and it's as though people tend to easily understand what they're talking about. In global surgery, that kind of easy access ease to getting that funding support or just support for what you're talking about is not there. Like it's easily there for other global health initiatives, right? You know, and there's a lot of difficulty when you look at the efforts you put in to try and convince policymakers and other organizations to support and understand that investment in global surgery is actually something that's cost effective and, you know, and there it gives compelling returns on investments. When you try to make that, pitch that to them, it's very difficult. Or like other global health initiatives, right? So if two of you are in the room and you're talking to the same people, when you're done, they're more likely to be towards the other party than towards you who's talking about and surgery, you know? So maybe, one of the things we're talking about of late is trying to change our messaging, you know, how we talk about these things to see how we can better, you know, I've had some great ideas come out from all of that discussion. And again, there's still a great disparity between training opportunities and expertise when you look at high-income countries and low-income countries compared to other global health initiatives. Like it's easier, you know, to have people from LMIC gain expertise in those fields that when it comes to global surgery, most of the trainings are still in the high-income countries. Very few are coming up in LMICs, but for other global health initiatives, you have a lot of these already existing in low-income countries. So these are areas that there are still differences and disparities, and you know, we see to
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. It kind of makes me wonder, like, what is so different about surgical care that makes it hard to advocate for at the policy or the, you know, the economic level, or like you said, like develop more training programs? And is it that surgical care just is more resource intensive? Is it that surgical care is more complicated? Yeah, I guess the, like, what are the, kind of the barriers that are unique to surgery that are making it more challenging to get buy-in for?
Well, surgeons are very focused on doing surgery. They're focused on advocacy efforts. They're not focused on changing public health or public policy. For example, you know, we can't have a bilateral exchange program between the U.S. and really any country around the world because we don't legally authorize any trainee or even fully trained practicing surgeon come and join us in any cases as an assistant, where we could discuss and learn and think about how to do something better. We can't do that legally. And unless there are surgeons who are advocating for those changes at every state or at the federal government, we're never going to change that. Now, granted, there are many, many of my colleagues who are working on that because we recognize that for bilateral engagement, partnership, learning, we need to have the same sort of allowances in the U.S. as you would anywhere else. We're not talking about having anything more than a way for people to engage in the fields that they are expert in with appropriate safeguards that we would have for anybody else. But that's a great example. It's just that we need to, as a specialty, as a community, work on advocacy, work on thinking about how do we change training programs, how do we create novel training programs, how do we conduct research in an ethical manner on surgical needs worldwide, not in an extractive manner, but and not in a manner that, you know, kind of keeps people from growing and becoming experts in their own countries, in their own contexts. So those are all things that we need to do, but that's a paradigm shift. Because at least for American surgeons, the focus has been, let's work on things in the U.S. And that's the end. But we live in a much more interconnected world, as Justina said earlier. And we need to recognize that we need to have involvement in all of those different areas as surgeons.
Yeah. I think that was a very great point you raised again, Suda. I remember as a medical student, you know, when you're taking your surgery classes, you know, anything public health was looked at like it was inferior to surgery. Yeah. You know, I mean, we're surgeons, you know, but, you know, it's like, that's an inferior field. But really, like we've been discussing, surgical care does not start out in the operating room. You have to get out there and advocate. And how best to advocate? Around the surgeons. You understand your field. And then there also grew this notion that investment in surgery was too expensive. Oh, you have to build theaters. You have to procure equipment. You have to do this. Oh, malaria, just give antimalarials, preventive therapy, HIV, get the drugs. But when it comes to surgery, oh, it's way too expensive. Until research started showing that, look, it's cost effective. And the return on investment is actually really good. You know, it builds the economy if you invest in surgical care. You know, and now that's, and then, well, there, and then there were studies that showed that, oh, when you invest, it was more cost effective to invest in surgical care than in TB, malaria, all of that. But then we realized that, and that what we have realized is when you go that line, it's like you're pitching a competition. Oh, come to us, don't go to there. So what we try to do now is, okay, when you, that has also been put forth, when you strengthen surgical care, strengthen the entire surgical system, because you strengthen the laboratory, you strengthen the blood bank system, you strengthen referrals, you strengthen everything. So when you invest in surgical care, you're actually investing in every other disease condition who ultimately at some point will require surgical care. You know, so we're like, look, it's not about I'm the one that owns this cake. No, we all come together to make this cake and we eat it together. So that's, you know, some of the things that we're trying to you know, did.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. You know, like surgical care, I think people find it at least at face value limiting because it requires different types of personnel and different, you know, physical resources and organizational resources. But to your point, those resources are used for so many other aspects of healthcare. And it's almost like if you can leverage the improvement of surgical care, the ripple effect is probably pretty large. Kind of going back towards, you know, I know we talked a lot about systems development and the importance of that factor. What do you think, like, what are the aspects of those systems that are often in need of most improvement and have the most impact if we're able to fix those things? Do you think it's more the personnel side? Is it more material resource side? Like, what are the spokes of the wheel, so to speak, of these systems-based improvements?
So that's one of the things that the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery tried to define back in 2015. When that series was published, it was the first systematic assessment of what surgical systems needed worldwide, like ever in the history of humanity, right? And that was 8 years ago, 9 years ago, I guess we can round out. But it was just kind of shocking to think about, no one has ever had asked that question before in that manner. But the things that they recognized, outlined, are things like human resources, as you mentioned, physical and infrastructure, equipment, data. What outcomes should we be pursuing? Should we be targeting? What milestones should we have? And then, of course, the economics of providing surgical services. Are some things more cost effective than others? And which types of operations should you start out with? You know, or when is it appropriate to build a transplant program? When is it appropriate to build a cardiac program? You know, we don't know the answers to those questions. We're starting to figure that out. So I think those are some of the main aspects that we need to think about. And that's part of the reason why we've had all these discussions about how do you train in, how do you teach that, how do you learn that, what are those fundamentals? Because if you ask most surgeons, you know, you can ask any of our colleagues who are in practice, who've been in practice for dozens of years, and ask them to discuss the economics of surgical care in the United States, they'll say, yeah, no, I'm not the person to be asked about it. It's not part of our education at all to think about any of these concepts, right? So it's something that's evolved in the last decade, but we don't actually know what these different endpoints are. So I think those four or five areas are probably the key spokes of systems as they apply to surgical care.
Yeah, absolutely. So that everything is important. You can't leave one out or the other. You can't. You can't train personnel without providing infrastructure. You can't provide services without providing a way for people to access the care. Mm-hmm. That's the economics of the funding part of it, right? So everything is interconnected. Everything just has to be there for each level of care, whatever is appropriate needs to be provided.
Definitely. Yeah, I feel like you said, that understanding or lack thereof of surgeons is probably a pretty rate-limiting factor. You know, I think that a lot of surgeons probably kind of think in this mindset of like, oh, well, like I am a plastic surgeon, like the solution is plastic surgery. Well, you know, maybe that's not the problem that you're trying to solve. And so, you know, to have that knowledge and to have that general understanding of these systems-based elements before approaching something like trying to improve care in a resource-limited setting is probably a better strategy than putting the cart before the horse, so to speak, with just trying to bring your surgical care somewhere else. You know, and I think that's kind of like probably a pitfall that a lot of people might fall into. So we've kind of touched on this a little bit, you know, in terms of some of the challenges that are encountered when trying to make systems-based improvements to surgical care access. You know, I think we talked a little bit about the economic side of things, kind of convincing people in positions of financial power that surgical initiatives are worth it. I think we talked about surgeons kind of needing the understanding of these broader concepts as a potential limitation. Could you talk some more about some of the challenges with creating these people in these communities that are able to provide the care themselves, you know, and like training paradigms and creating training programs and the key components of those developments.
Yeah, let me ask you something. Can you describe for me what the training program is in Botswana for general surgery?
I have no idea.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly it, is that it, even if our colleagues in Botswana want to improve their systems, if they don't have a sense of what the training paradigms are in other places, they can't make any changes, right? So it has to be, there has to be bilateral and collaborative partnerships that involve teaching and understanding of the uniqueness of different contexts and what is necessary or acceptable in each setting, right? So for a surgical program, training program in a particular country, you know, it might come down to saying, okay, well, how are our hospitals organized? What happens when you finish a surgical residency? Where do you get a job? Or how do you get into a surgical residency? Do you need to work for a few years and then give up that job and move to a different city and then not get paid to be a surgical resident? How would you support your family during that time? There are a lot of systems-related issues that come up, even if you just think about education. So it's quite normal, for example, in some countries where to become a surgeon, you finish medical school, you have to go out and practice in a rural place for a couple of years, and by which time, generally, most people are starting to have families, and then you have to move again, and then you have to quit your job and not have an income when you have a family to do your surgical residency training. And then during that time, you actually will have to work a part-time job because you need to have some income to be able to support your family. Now, whatever surgical residency training paradigms we use in the U.S., why not apply to that setting? Because if we say, well, you should have these cases and you should have this, well, you have no idea what this, the processes and standards and systems are in that setting to be able to apply just carte blanche. This is what you should do to improve your production of surgical of surgeons. So really working closely with the stakeholders, understand what the what that particular context means and what systems exist there and what possible ideas might come from other settings. It is really important. So getting the right stakeholders engaged, understanding the system, understanding what opportunities and resources there may be are critical aspects that need to be thought about for any kind of global surgical partnership and get the works on capacity building.
Well said. I mean, you just said it. Yeah. The governments and experts, stakeholders needs to come together and in their own setting, right? And develop what's locally contextualized and work for them rather than just wait for someone to come do it or just pick something from somewhere else and just apply it. You have to, it has to be locally contextualized. And another thing is that I think there are a few efforts that are going on to try and address these issues, but sometimes when you look at them in NMI, since they appear to be siloed and splintered, everybody's doing something somewhere, right? There's a need for a convergence of these efforts so that the results can be more, you know, we can see more impactful rather than having siloed, you know, efforts going on around the place. Yeah.
Is GICS a good example of a collaborative effort?
Absolutely.
What's your experience there?
Global Initiative for Children's Surgery, it's a fantastic example of collaboration where you have LMIC practitioners and high-income country practitioners coming together, right, to try and improve access to pediatric children's surgical care. Okay, and everything that's done there has significant LMIC input and HIC input as well. And nobody is trying to say, oh, this is how it has to be done. It has to be locally contextualized wherever it's going to, whatever is happening, is going to happen, right? It has to be done in a way that is sustainable and will work in that setting. Okay, it's not an imposition of an idea from somewhere on a particular setting. No, what is being done, it's equitable. I think that's just the word I need to use. It's an equitable partnership of or collaboration of different practices all around the world, right? And all the work that has gone on has been very helpful and impactful for LMIC because there's a lot of input from the LMIC partners, like the OREX document that was produced. That was the basis for which Nigeria included children's surgery in her national surgical plan. That was our roadmap for including it. And that was developed by GICS, you know, but there was LMIC context in it. So it could easily be applied to develop that. And so just, that's just one of the ways where this has worked.
That's great. Yeah. And I think that definitely highlights probably the foundational concept, which is transparency of how training works and what, you know, maybe other people are doing, but also that needs to be taken in the context of where you are and the stakeholders that are involved there. And, you know, I think surgical training is a whole other topic within itself. You know, like as a surgical trainee, you know, there's certainly tons of improvements that can be made here. And I'm sure that's the case everywhere else. And I think that it's such a challenging question to answer when you're trying to consider what makes a competent surgeon trainee, what deems that person appropriate for practice. And I can imagine that, you know, when you take the local context into perspective of that, and even gets more challenging, but to have real conversations and have collaboration is probably a step in the right direction for those things. Looking towards the future, you know, whether it's the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, are there any particular areas or factors that you anticipate having the most influence in improving global surgery access?
I think one of the most important lessons that the surgical community has learned is really advocacy, and advocacy within each of our countries, advocacy at a more central level, like at the UN or at the World Health Assembly. And that probably is a huge part of the future for global surgery. And because you have to change what the people who are setting policy and funding initiatives have to think. You know, it takes a lot of effort and finances to invest in surgical systems, as it does for all health systems.
Mm-hmm.
And so until surgeons are beating the drum at that level consistently in every government, in every entity, I don't think you can make progress of the kind that we want to make.
All right. So I think, you know, kind of the final question I'll pose to both of you is, for our trainee listeners and young surgeons, folks that are students might be interested in this kind of work, any final words of wisdom for surgeons or trainees early on who are inspired to get involved with global surgery work?
I think just keep staying inspired through training. Training is hard, and it's going to take a lot of time and energy and hard work. But to keep the light alive inside of you for the difference that you want to make in the world, and find various mentors. They might not even know that they're mentors. Like Charlie Mock was for me. Like, he didn't know that I existed for another 10 years after I first heard about his work. You know, I think find the people who inspire you, follow their careers, and keep them in mind as inspiration as you go through training. And, you know, always remember what motivated you to start down this path. This is an amazing career, medicine, surgery. It's an honor to be able to take care of patients who really would suffer enormously without our being there to help support them through some really terrible things. So just have that perspective, have that reminder, and then keep going. There's so much that can be done. We've only scratched the surface, and what we can do. There's a lot of opportunity out there, and you can create more and more. I think the students and trainees are probably the most inspiring, if you ask me, because they come up with new ways of thinking about how to approach things. And that's really exciting.
Yeah. So what do I see after Shadan said everything? Yeah. What do I see? Well, evolving global surgery is very satisfying. Gives you an opportunity to impact a larger population than you would be able to impact just in the operating room. And there's room for everyone. Within your region, you can get involved. Across continents, you can get involved, right? And it creates opportunities for collaboration, and then you make lifelong friends, you know? Also, maybe it goes beyond the work. I've made very good friends, you know, outside of the workspace just by being involved in global surgery. So it's basically limitless. There's opportunities for everyone at all levels, like I said before, medical student, resident doctors, specialists, other non-surgical, core surgical staff. There's room for anyone.
Great. Well, that was very inspiring. Thank you both. All right. So we'll just start to wrap up here. A couple key points from conversation that we had. I think first and foremost, there's so much impact to be had when things are improved at a systems level and creating better quality access to surgical care. Surgical care does not start and stop within the operating room. I think that an understanding of the needs and economics of existing systems in these areas is critical to success. I think you need to start with understanding the problem without and not just coming to the table with a solution in mind already. Improving surgical care certainly has the potential to improve all care across health in general. And so investing in surgical care, rising tide raises all ships, so to speak, when it comes to healthcare and investing in improving surgical care. And finally, when considering creating training programs or creating initiatives related to improving surgical access, keeping that local context in mind and also having transparency across efforts is critical to creating sustainable change that improves. So I just want to thank both of you again. Thank you, Dr. Jayaraman and Dr. Shay Olajide. I think all of us and the listeners will certainly have learned a lot from both your perspectives on what global surgery is and how important that broad understanding of all of the systems-based aspects at play is so critical to improving surgical access. We deeply appreciate your time and, of course, your work. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to keep an eye out for future Behind the Knife Global Surgery series episodes that are up and coming. If you're interested in more topics or have any suggestions in regards to our global surgery content, please feel free to contact us at hello@behindtheknife.org. That concludes our episode. We hope that you're inspired and are much more familiar with how global surgery has grown over the years, and it's become definitely an area of large influence worldwide. We appreciate your listening, and until next time, dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org for more great content. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, dominate the day.